Welcome to Planet Marzipan Podcast,
your fish and Marillion podcast,
where we talk about all things in the planet of Marillion and fish. I'm Meza, and here's my mate,
Craig Houston.
Hello, and welcome to Planet Marzipan. It's one of our mini pods, one of our Charting the Single pods. So I'm Meza, and I'm here with my glamorous assistant,
Craig.
Craig Houston.
Fergusted.
We have guests with us today. So we're welcoming back Graeme Tennick.
Hi, I'm just laughing at fake gusto. Whatever it is.
Bloody balls.
Hi, sorry.
Yeah. We're also welcoming back Tim Sidwell. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
And we have a Planet Marzipan virgin, Stephen Wicks, joins us, aka Mochillion.
Oh, hi, guys. Yeah, I hope you're not bringing that up. But anyway, yes, thanks for having me.
Should we move on? Should we gloss over that?
Yeah, let's move on. Okay.
You may know Stephen's work from Mochillion on Facebook. So we're here to talk about Punch and Judy, the first single from Fugazi. We've got Graeme on the pod because I believe this was his first single. But before that, because it's Stephen's first time on Planet Marzipan.
Marzipan.
Two drinks in. We get to ask him how he first heard about the band.
Well, briefly first heard about them. I've got three older brothers and two of them well into prog. And one recorded the Friday Night Rock Show session. I think it was 82, was it? And I do remember distinctly hearing Forgotten Sons off of that. I'm thinking that was brilliant. But personally, got into them properly when I first saw them live, which is 1984, and Milton Keynes supporting Status Quo. And they were fantastic that day. I quick look at the set list. And it's interesting, people sometimes complain, they always play, new stuff and not play much old stuff. That day, the set list was all of Fugazi and Cinderella Search and only two songs off script. So they were already, at a festival. So it just shows the voice, doesn't it? And they were brilliant at the start with Assassin. And it was... Initially, I think it was the impact of Fish coming on and how we held the crowd and how we got the crowd clapping along to fairly complex lyrics and interact with them. And then as time went on, you saw the band and the other stuff for Fugazi is particularly strong, I think. And by the end of their support slot, I was kind of sold on them. They were brilliant.
Had you heard them before?
Yeah, I'd say the Friday Rock Show sessions that my brother had played me, but I'd not gone. Yeah.
Had any of the recorded, properly recorded.
No, so I went back, got Fugazi, got script, and then Mistress Childhood came out. So I was one of the fans that was my first proper album. And
really?
Sort of got into them at the right time, really.
And then a few quid later, you're here now.
Yeah, just a bit. Yeah. Precious now. If you can go and rack it and look at all your orders and copy them into a spreadsheet and see how much you've spent over the years, I don't recommend it.
No, don't do that. Although there is, every time I do that, I can hear Lucy's voice cackling in my ears, as I get further down the list.
Trips to Miami.
It's like, I wonder how many Marillion fans have got a little note in their will saying, don't tell my wife the password for my Discogs account.
No, do.
Yeah, so she can sell it and make it big.
Yeah, you want it to go for the right amount of money, absolutely. Okay, so we're going to talk about Punch and Judy today. Punch and Judy has a Wikipedia entry, so I'm just going to read from the Wikipedia entry briefly. Punch and Judy is a song by the British neo-progressive band Marillion. It was the first single from their second studio album, Fugazi, and the lyrics of the song are about a marriage gone bad. The single reached number 29 on the UK singles chart in February 1984, and this was the only single during the band's EMI years that no music video was shot for. It was released on the 30th of January, 84. Gray, I believe this was your first Marillion single.
It was. I first heard it on the Friday Night Rock Show. That was it. So I'd heard people at school playing Marillion, but I'd never paid any attention. But it was like, I used to listen to Friday Night Rock Show religiously. And I remember when Punch and Judy came on, I was like, hang on a minute, what is this? And I went out with a couple of mates. I think it was the Sleeves Records in Falkirk, and picked up the 12-inch single. I never looked back. That was it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I think within a week, I also had script and all the stuff from that as well, because it was so different to everything else I'd listened to by that up until that point, really.
What other stuff were you listening to at that time?
I was into Iron Maiden, Queen, and The Cult. So it was like a really quite a diverse group. My dad had been into prog, and I think we mentioned this previously, prog and art rock and heavy metal and stuff. So I had those influences. It was actually my school teacher. One of my school teachers, my music teacher, was into prog. So started giving me things like, you know, go and listen to Trick of the Tail, go and listen to this, go and listen to that. And I am still friends with that music teacher now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was it. But when I heard this, I was just like, okay, this is it.
That was similar to my school, but it wasn't the music department who were all into prog. It was the science department.
Really?
So like the chemistry teachers, the physics teachers, the biology teachers were all heavily into their prog. And Phil Taylor, who was my biology teacher, we stayed friends right until he passed. And he used to come to gigs with us. He did the Haddington weekends everything. And he's a massive Fish and Marillion fan and much, much missed.
Lovely guy. It was really, really, yeah. What do we think about the track itself? It's a little bit different, I think. It's kind of almost like a Bo Diddley
staccato of Kane.
Yeah, it's. I noticed when we're just doing the research on it that Jonathan Moover gets a writing credit on this. So it's from his short period of the band that they sort of worked up this track up. Ian does get some credits on some of the other tracks on the album, but he doesn't get credit on this.
Well, Ian basically came in, didn't he, at the last minute for the recording sessions of Fugazi, you know, driven to Rockfield Studios. Well, no, he drove over to Rockfield Studios, picked Rothers and Pete up from Aylesbury and drove them over, and that was his baptism of fire. So he was kind of like, he moved into the band as all this was being written and recorded.
Yeah, yeah. But I think from the fact that Marta's credited on Punch and Judy, it must have been one of the first tracks this kind of worked up.
Maybe one of the earlier tracks, yeah.
He's credited for two tracks on this, isn't he?
Sorry, did I say Marta? I meant Jonathan Moover.
Mover.
Yeah. I'm really sorry. Jonathan Moover is credited with the writing.
It's difficult to keep up because there's about 15 drummers on that.
I know, this is the Spinal Tap era, isn't it? This, yeah.
So he's credited with writing, but he's not got a playing credit, has he?
No, he hasn't. No. So, yeah, Jonathan Moover was involved in the writing of this. But, yeah, as I erroneously said, John Marta recorded the two B-sides, which were. Yeah. Versions of Market Square here, re-recorded versions of Market Square Heroes and Three Boats Down from the Candy, which I believe they were recorded with the intention of putting them out in America.
Yep, there's a note on the back of the single.
Do you want to read it? Yeah, you read it. I'll hold it from here and you read it from there.
No? Someone's getting on, you know. I haven't got my proper reading glasses on.
Shall I read it?
Yeah. No, go for it.
It really does start with this.
So here I am once more.
The tracks on the B-side of this record, originally recorded in September 82 as the first release of the band, were re-recorded with John Marta on drums at the Marquee Studios in September 83 for an interim release in the USA in spring 84. As we enter the phase of the second album, Fugazi, we decided to release these versions of Market Square Heroes and Three Boats Down from the Candy in the UK and to place the originally planned B-side on the upcoming album to take its playing time to approximately 48 minutes. We hope you find the development of these tracks over the first year as interesting and enjoyable as we have. Thanks for the support through the year of the script, and we hope to see you on the next tour. One more experience, one more entry in a diary self-pen.
You should have sung that.
So I met Johnny Marta last year.
Did you?
Yeah. Bizarrely, me and Jez Mason, who's worked on all the Marillion films for the last few years, well, the last 10 years actually with me, we were filming a live stream of a blues night at Basingstoke Irish Centre.
As you do.
And it was a really, really good evening, long evening, 3 hours of constant blues music. And it was a tribute show for one of their members that had passed away. And Johnny Marta appeared on drums on some incarnation of a band that was on there. And I went up and had a chat with him afterwards and told him that I was involved with Marillion. And he said, oh, man, that's amazing. I had some great times with the band. And he still remembers them fondly. He's still in touch with them as well. And he recounted stories of sharing hotel rooms with Mad Jack in New York and
And what was the other one? Yeah, the Reading Festival that he played. He was brought in at the last minute to play the Reading Festival and said that he really relied on Pete to give him cues for drum fills and, you know, changes in things like Grendel. Yeah, he had to do Grendel, didn't he?
Yeah.
Like 2 minutes practice and was sort of thrown into to do Grendel. Yeah. So he's looking for Pete to sort of do that with his bass just so he didn't miss a beat. So, yeah, he was a lovely chap.
Oh, brilliant. John Martin.
Great drummer as well.
Am I right in thinking John Martin drummed for Fish as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a Fish connection as well.
The Market Square Heroes and Three Boats, the two versions back to back, sort of preparation for this. And I was surprised how much of difference there was, really. I don't know if I thought that, but the second version, the energy, and, you know, H talks his podcast about the percussionist they got, talk about being on the front beat and the back beat and the middle beat. And if you compare the two, the original sounds a little bit ploddy because the beat, and I've started to describe, I'm not a musician, but the beat just sounds really sharp and on it. The production sounds like an 80s production, whereas the original's more 70s sounding production. And Fisher's vocals are a lot more sort of acerbic, more in line with what he was like on Fugazi, I think, than script in certain parts. In fact, you know, Three Boats could be from Fugazi if you think of some of the lyrics about, you know, romanticising ruin like debauchery rain. That's very Fugazi type sort of.
Yeah.
You can see they were heading towards that sort of place. And it just stands out to me how much better, in my view, those versions were than the originals, really.
And also, it's where we were talking about on the pod, on the last lot of the pods, when we did Market Square Heroes. There's two different versions on the 7-inch and the 12-inch.
Yeah.
And the 12-inch is actually where, because I couldn't find it originally when we were looking, where the piece signs in the disco lyric comes from on a studio version, and that's the actual only studio version on the 12-inch one that actually has that lyric on.
Was that added on? I always think that verse sounds a bit like it was just plonked on at the end and doesn't really belong.
They sung it live on the script tour. It was there on the tour, but it was never on the recorded version. And then they added it to the recorded version on the extended version for the 12-inch of this. So it's not on the 7-inch version, but it's on the 12-inch version. So well, that's correcting themselves.
Yeah, that is us correcting something we said in an earlier podcast, because we said there wasn't a recorded studio version with that lyric, but there is.
And it's that one.
It's that one. Gray, have you got any views on the re-recorded versions?
Was everything re-recorded on it?
Those two tracks,
That was it's complete re-recorded.
Yes, completely.
It ties in with what Steve was saying. There's a bite to them, which there wasn't in the originals. I don't think they're played any more forcefully. I don't think there's more experience to them, having played them live for as long. So I think there's definitely more bite to it, and I don't think you could put it any better than Steve, like playing it. That the difference between plodding along and driving the song.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's necessarily the drumming or if it's the whole thing, because the band's had the experience to get behind the song.
I think listening to Three Boats, there's certainly more Kelly flourishes on the intro than there are in the original. It struck me the production is really sharp. As Stephen says, it's kind of like 80s compared with 70s. It's really bright and sharp.
Still Nick Tauber produced it.
Yeah. Yeah. Any views on those, Tim?
No, only what the other guys have said. Yeah, but when I'd listened to them, they feel a lot poppier. And that's to do with the production, obviously.
What do you think of the A-side then, Punch and Judy?
It was a weird one for me because my introduction to Marillion was with the second single, which we'll talk about in another time.
Yeah.
So to go from Assassin to Punch and Judy was a bit of a shift change in my, you know, uneducated Marillion ears. And I think in between discovering Marillion with Assassin and then hearing Punch and Judy, I think I'd already found Script and listened to that. And so Punch and Judy was a bit of a strange one, I think.
Yeah.
I think the band think it's quite a strange one as well, just with that kind of syncopated beat and the way that the song's actually constructed. It's strange choice for a single, really.
I think it's just the length of it, isn't it, that makes it the single. If you look at the tracks on Fugazi, it's just the length.
There's a bit of a hook at the beginning with the keyboard. And I think when I hear it now, because I saw it live first, maybe, I think about the way Fish got everyone clapping along. Is it 7/8 time? Fish got everyone clapping along, and that becomes the rhythm of the song. And certain songs, even when they play them now with H, the crowd clap in the same rhythm that Fish used to get his clapping along to in the 80s, because it gets in our memory, got in our memory so much. Mm. And that was one of those songs.
I'm going to have to comment now. I'm going to have to, because that's twice it seems we've gone about the clapping. You can tell that Marillion have got a cut above when it's a fan base. They can clap in 7/8 and everybody does it in time. Most pop bands can't even get somebody to clap in 4/4. There's like some of those rhythms you used to clap at the early gigs were just phenomenal. And he was skipping beats and all sorts of things, and everybody did it in time. It was just unbelievable.
It's one of those things you could never, especially in early Marillion, you could never get ever romantic to those songs, could you?
No.
But it's got a great chorus, hasn't it? The song's got a great chorus, got a great driving force, the chorus.
Yeah.
It's really hooky.
If you take it, it's hard to interpret the lyric without looking in hindsight about what Punch and Judy actually is.
Mm.
What, you know, it's never acceptable but the Punch and Judy show, for people who don't know, was a Victorian sort of puppet show for children where a male puppet would beat his wife for comic effect and then get hung, I think, by a policeman. That was kind of the story of it. And so Fish is in his Let Romance Slowly Ruin sort of phase, he's drawing a comparison with marriage, with that sort of relationship. And so take that in context, the word punch, and if you punch as he sings it, has got that punch to it. It's a very, what's the word? The word is similar to the meaning of the word is similar to the sound of it.
Onomatopoeic.
That's right.
Onomatopoeic, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very bitten off, that word, isn't it? He does. He really does.
He spits it pretty much, yeah.
That's, yeah.
And I think possibly the subject matter and timing could be one of the reasons why there's actually no promo video for the song. Because Fish had mentioned it a while back on Fish on Friday, where they had an initial concept of a video for the single to do with a boxing ring. Now, that would have gone down. Really, really like, no. So I think it's possibly a good thing that it didn't happen. And the only AMI song that doesn't have a video.
It shows how the context of a piece of art is very much, you know, how you read it, how you hear it, and how you view it is based on the medium. And a visual medium of that song could be very, very distasteful. I think the song
you're right, 100%.
Outside of things, because it's not saying anything sort of positive about that subject. So it's just drawing lines of, you know, disillusionment. You could take it as a bit of a whinge, you know, one of these man babies that gets married and doesn't like kind of responsibility. Or you could take it as somebody who's cynically looking at marriage as something, because their heart's been broken, that is something that isn't worth sort of pursuing. But you can take it how you want it. There's more sort of scope to that, and therefore it works, and it still works, and you can listen to it without feeling uncomfortable. I'm not sure you could say the same if they made a video.
Yeah, well, also
I don't think that's the reason there's not a video, though. I think the reason there's not a video is because they were still mixing the album at this point.
Yeah.
So they were in different studios recording and mixing right up to the tour. So there was no time to film a video.
Yeah, but lyrically, we still talked about lyrics, though, is when Fish wrote this, he was only in, not even his mid-20s. So he had no life experience of this. He had no life experience of a long, long term.
There's a naivety to it.
Yeah, like no long-term like wife or anything like that was on the cards for till a number of years later.
On the back of the single, it talks about the projected B-side. That was due to be Emerald Lies. So,
yep. One of your favourites there, John?
It's all right, Emerald Lies. It's all right.
Better
than She Chameleon.
Oh, I like She Chameleon. Get away. Get away.
We had this on the Fugazi pod.
Yeah, we did. I'll just chuck that one in. Apologies. I like Emerald Lies, but there you go. What do you think to the sleeve, Mark Wilkinson's artwork?
I don't think he's very happy with that. I remember
it's the legs, I think, that he's unhappy with. Yeah,
they're very dangly, aren't they? I remember when we interviewed him, he came in to do the interviews for the script documentary, and at the same time we thought we'd cover the artwork for Fugazi. And yeah, that's one of his least favourite covers. It was done in a rush.
I think it would work without the legs on it, actually. That on its own would work, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but for me, it doesn't. For me, the legs work because it's a puppet.
Yeah.
It's a puppet, so the legs hang.
Yeah.
You don't. So, and that's how I always, until I heard that point where Mark Wilkinson's going, I don't like them. I'd never even thought about it as being bad until the artist points out, I don't like my legs. You go, oh yeah, they're not as good as the rest of the drawing, are they?
But it's like, if you'd see the Punch and Judy show back in the day, you would have saw the hand thing and then the legs would have flopped
the
over.
Legs, yeah, you know, so exactly.
It's the way that the style of what the performance used to be like.
But you say about a video not being made potentially because of the subject matter, that cover's very, it could be very offensive, couldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the same point about the medium. For me, the two singles, this and The Sassing, goes from one of the worst of the covers of that era, Punch and Judy, to one of the best, which was The Sassing, which is, you know, phenomenal.
But it was always, that was, we'll get to it when it happens, but that was controversial as well.
We'll talk about that in another podcast, even.
don't shoot
your load, mate. We've just arrived.
But there were T-shirts with it on, weren't they? And it's an old T-shirt, don't you think?
Yeah. I never bought a T-shirt with a Punch and Judy sleeve on, that's for sure.
One thing, though, on the back cover, which is a bit odd, is if you look at the back cover, it's got the rings, and it's just like the...
Looney Tunes.
Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
So right. Does that really fit? Does it?
I don't know.
Is the rainbow so part of Fish's lyrical themes? Is rainbows? Is maybe it's alluding to that, I don't know. Mm. Was it rainbows on Fugazi? I can't remember. Possibly not.
It's more misplaced. I don't know.
Anyway.
Anywho.
But it was released on, was it 7-inch, 12-inch, and the 12-inch?
It was, yeah. Do you want to do track list, Craig? Do you want to do track list?
And it's funny because I've actually got all three of them. I've actually gotten... and play a vinyl thing. I've
just for the record, with Craig Houston.
I've actually got all three. I've got all three.
Wow.
So 7-inch has got the fact that they've all got the same tracks except the slight variations. Punch and Judy is just the album version. I don't think there's a single edit to it.
No.
There's an edited version of Market Square Heroes, but still the full version of Three Boats Down from the Candy on the B-side, which is quite a lot for one B-side there. And the A-side on the 12-inch is Punch and Judy. The B-side is the extended version of Market Square Heroes. Even though it doesn't say it, it is. And you've got the same version of Three Boats Down from the Candy. Picture Discs just got the same tracks as normal 12-inch.
Both the edit and the extended version of Market were both the re-recorded versions, weren't they?
Yeah.
So there's a 7-inch version of it and a 12-inch version of it.
It's about 50 seconds longer. 50 seconds longer, yeah. But the short version doesn't include the disco lyric, and the long version does.
And if you want them on streaming, they are available on the singles box set.
And this version...
I've got that somewhere.
The 82 to 89 box set is available to streamers 80. If you haven't got the little fashion.
82 to 88. Series.
The 82 to 88.
And this version of Market Square Heroes is the one on Best of Both Worlds, not the single.
There you go.
Is this version available? Is this version on the deluxe set as well? Or is that another one?
No.
It's another one, isn't it?
Well, no, they've got Three Boats Down from the Candy on the deluxe set on the Blu-ray, but Market Square Heroes isn't on it at all.
Oh, is that a complaint?
No.
That was Graham Tennant, Lucy. Listen, Graham Tennant.
Okay. If you're going to be a complaint, if you're going to put extras on and put the B-sides and what have you, you might as well put them all on.
Anyhow.
Do you want to talk that Top of the Pops appearance and scaring the kids?
Yeah. Do you remember that?
That was their second appearance on Top of the Pops after Garden Party. It's available on YouTube for you to laugh and point at how confused a lot of these like young 17 or 18-year-old girls are who are used to think, where's Duran?
Well, back to the time signature, they would have just been trying to dance to it or move to it on the camera, wouldn't they?
I think that probably explains a lot of my mates' kind of indifference to Marillion at the time. They just couldn't get a handle on what they were about.
Yeah.
And that's only because their only exposure to them were those couple of appearances on Top of the Pops. Like one minute they're talking about garden parties and all that kind of stuff. The next minute they're talking about divorce and what's all this about?
Even on the Blu-ray from the Fugazi set, Steve Rothery does mention that they came in at, was it they came in at 29 and scared the kids, they appeared on Top of the Pops, they dropped down the charts the following week.
I find it funny we're talking about the subject matter for Punch and Judy's video, because isn't this around the same time as Duran Duran had girls on film, wrestling video?
Maybe that's the way it could have gone. Oh.
I'm thinking back to the days. Oh yeah,
yeah. So blatant sexism is all right, but not assault and battery.
I think that rule still applies, doesn't it?
Now, come on, we've had complaints because we're all a bunch of middle-aged men talking about music. So
there's a couple of us are middle-aged mammals, aren't we?
Yes, that's true.
Well, that's going to be the T-shirt for the podcast now. Just a bunch of, well, middle-aged mammals. That's even better. On that bombshell, any final words on Punch and Judy?
Graham. It lasted 4 weeks in the charts, and it peaked in its first week at number 29, then went down to 32, 36, 54 and out.
Ooh. I'm really sorry, Jimmy Savile. I should have come to you earlier with that, shouldn't I? But
now then.
I really like it. I think in the album as well, in the track listing, it sits really nicely between Assassin and Jigsaw.
Yeah.
And I think I'm probably lucky that I heard that first. Because if I'd heard something longer and stranger first, I probably wouldn't have got into the band as much as I did. So I heard that, which got me into the band, and then I went and sort of researched and thought, hang on a minute.
I think it benefits what's all this? In a way, because you get the energy of the vocals without dissecting the lyrics live. You get the performance of the vocalist and enjoy the music, and the energy comes across really well. Whereas I think you listen to this song, if that was your first song you'd heard by the band, and you start listening to the lyrics, you'd think, what on earth? Yeah, like you say.
Is this one of the tracks they played on the Oxford Road show? That stunned silence. I shall look at that. I have to say it, because I'd seen the band on the Script Tour. I was a little bit disappointed with Punch and Judy, if I'm honest. It just didn't sit with the rest of the stuff that they were doing. But we'd already heard the Radio 1 broadcast of Reading, so we knew we'd heard Assassin or a version of Assassin. So it didn't get me down too much, but it just wasn't quite as exciting as what I'd heard from them before, if I'm honest.
Is that because of the style of music or because?
Really. It's
not proggy at all. It's nothing.
It wasn't, was it, at all? It was just, it was a pop rock song.
Yeah.
With angry lyrics.
Well, there you go. But yeah, it's horses for courses, isn't it? Some people love it. Some people not so fond of it. Anything else you want to say about it? No.
They go the tumbleweeds.
The jury says no. Okay.
Not one of their strongest singles, but...
The next one in the history.
Next one in the history.
Okay. So that's the end of this mini pod. So it's good night from Graham.
Good night.
Stephen.
Good night.
Tim.
Good night.
And it's Great. Good night from... I was going to say it's good night from me as well.
And it's good night from John Boy too. Take care.
And stay alive.
Thanks for listening to Planet Marzipan Podcast. Please like and subscribe from whichever platform you get your podcasts from. You can contact us at planetmarzipanpodcast@gmail.com and check out marillion.com, fishmusic.scot or fishmusic.eu for all the good stuff.